insights, interviews, and best practices by clinicians for clinicians. Welcome to GE Healthcare's Clinical View Podcast.
Top Bed Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Euro Anesthesia 2022, day 3 in Milano, Italy. I'm Desiree Chappell, your host, and I'm joined by Monty Mithen from Top Med Talk. Hello, Monty.
Hi, Desiree. Great to still be here on day 3.
It is day 3. Top Med Talk on the GE Healthcare booth here in the trade exhibition.
Yeah, very grateful for their sponsorship, which allows us to provide free open access medical education.
Yes, absolutely. It's been wonderful to be back and see some friends. For sure.
We've caught up with a lot of people. It's been quite a buzz here. It's good.
Yeah, it's great. Well, also joining us is our friend Solomon Aronson. Hello, Saul.
How are you, Desiree? And Monty, how much is the open access education?
Free.
It's free. It is free.
No,
that's free, free. That's European free.
Free, free.
Do you understand that?
I believe that's free.
Free, completely free.
Excellent.
Yeah, everything that we do here on Top Med Talk is completely free. Generous support from all of our sponsors.
Thank you very much indeed.
Absolutely. Well, great conversation since we've been here at the meeting. Covered several different topics, a lot around monitoring, intra-op morbidity, post-op morbidity, all those different things. Some of the highlights so far.
So we've been visiting once again blood pressure because it's one of the hot topics. For those of you who are new to TopMed Talk, if you go into our search engine, we've covered off pretty much everything in the perioperative space quite extensively, so don't think we're just obsessed with blood pressure and post-op.
We talk about everything.
That's where we are right at the moment.
Yeah.
So we've heard the results of some very large, impressive trials, for example, about patient warming, about breath sizes and PEEP during anesthesia, and about blood pressure management and, for example, the use of tranexamic acid. So if you look at the interviews from yesterday and the day before, quite a lot of things which people tend to badge as negative trials, in other words, very large trials that say in these pragmatic situations intraoperatively, it's not clear that many of those things make that much difference to outcomes.
Yeah, and so everybody wants to say that's negative.
Negative. No, it's not. It's an important thing to say, don't be too obsessed about the temperature you're trying to manage the patient at within these boundaries.
Right.
Temperature management is important. And if we take the tranexamic acid one, for example, where there's a long history of smaller and increasingly larger trials showing that bleeding is decreased.
Yep.
Bleeding was decreased,
but
it also reassured us about safety.
Right.
So they're really important trials. Now, one of the caveats with that is the blood pressure one, for example, the second component of POISE 3. One simple takeaway message could be that blood pressure management does not matter.
Yeah.
But that's not what the trial showed us.
Yeah.
Almost no patient in a 7,500 plus patient study looking intraoperatively, where they were randomized to either avoid hypotension or hypertension, almost no patient went below a threshold of 60.
Yeah.
And these were hypertensive patients on at least one medication. Now, we know that's very unusual.
Yeah.
So they're already unusual to be in that category. And in the signal separation between those trying to achieve a level of 80 and 60, there wasn't that much difference between the two groups.
Yes.
I think the big takeaway from it was that somewhere in that 60 to 70-ish range is still the reference point against which we should judge subsequent trials. I'll be quiet in a second because the other discussion point that we want to go into in a moment is, are we just looking in the wrong place?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's easy to look intraoperatively.
Yes.
But we're told that all the real badness happens postoperatively. So are we looking, as I said yesterday, under the lamp, even though we dropped our keys somewhere else?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're going to go, with our guest into those two points.
Absolutely. Well, let's go ahead and introduce our guest today. We have Bernd Sagel from Hamburg, Germany. Bernd, thank you so much for joining us today on Top Med Talk. I know you've been very busy here at Euro Anesthesia 2022. I think I was looking at like 7 different lectures and participation in events throughout the meeting.
I stopped counting. Yeah.
Well, I know you came just from a session. So thank you for taking the time out to join us. For those who may not know you, tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Absolutely. My name is Bernd Sagel. I'm from Hamburg in Germany. So I'm a professor of anesthesiology and the vice chair of the Department of Anesthesiology at the University Medical Center in Hamburg in Germany. And, well, my research interests are the optimization of cardiovascular dynamics in high-risk patients having surgery and in critically ill patients. And I especially focus on concepts of personalizing hemodynamics with regards to blood pressure and even cardiac output.
Oh, interesting. Well, we want to deep dive into all those things, but we've had a lot of conversation here over the meeting about several different topics. Monty, some of the things we've been talking to Bernd about.
So, the first section of this discussion, but I want to pick off two things. One is whether, and this is a loaded question, one is whether choosing the blood pressure as a treatment target is too simplistic. Mm. Because, you know, we know that we can hit that target by starting a vasopressor infusion and do what might be the wrong thing to achieve the right number. And the second one, which I know you're very interested in, is about if we aren't going to personalize that blood pressure number, what should that blood pressure number be? So number one, the simple target of blood pressure. Too simple?
In my opinion, it's too simple. Yeah. What we know now, of course, is that there is an association between hypotension and low blood pressure during surgery and postoperative organ injury. And if we look at the population level, the population harm threshold usually is around 60 to 65 for mean arterial pressure. So when you look at the whole population, this is a point where the risk kind of goes up for postoperative organ injury. And now we have a couple of trials, three or four actually, that tried to compare different blood pressure targets. The biggest trial so far, of course, is what you already mentioned, the POISE 3 trial. That is not published yet, but from what we know, they compared two different fixed blood pressure targets and didn't find a difference in outcome. The same, by the way, is true for a study that was published last year by Banner et al., substantially smaller trial than POISE 3, but still more than 450 patients, and they also compared two fixed blood pressure targets, like more maintaining a mean arterial pressure above 65 versus a higher threshold, but again, fixed thresholds, and they didn't find a difference in patient-centered outcomes too. And then we have a third trial that I find very interesting, and that is the IMPRESS trial that was published a couple of years ago in the JAMA, and what the authors did there, they tried to individualize blood pressure based on the preoperative systolic blood pressure. So specifically, they measured systolic blood pressure during when they checked the patient before surgery, and if that value was not available, they did it the day before surgery on the normal ward. But it was a single blood pressure reading in the resting patient, and they then took this systolic blood pressure and they tried to maintain it within a 10% range during surgery. And there are a couple of limitations with this trial, including that there were two different vasopressors in the two groups, and that the endpoint is a little bit unusual because it was a composite of systemic inflammatory response syndrome and at least one organ failure in at least one major organ system. But this trial was successful in the terms that individualizing treatment improved outcomes. The other trials were neutral. I don't like to speak about them as a negative trial, but they were neutral. So there's some... at least a hint that individualizing blood pressure targets may be the way to go.
Yeah.
So how do we individualize
that? That's what I was just going to ask. How do we
get
there?
That is the big question, of course, and at least I can say what we shouldn't do.
Yeah.
So first of all, I think that what Fautier and colleagues did with a single measurement, this is a little bit too simple because we know from cardiology that a single measurement hardly reflects personal blood pressure physiology. So this is something that we know for years because there is white coat hypertension. This is people being hypertensive only when they are at the doctor but not when they're home. But there's also the opposite, like masked hypertension. So yeah. They feel safe when they see a doctor and they are not hypertensive there, but they are hypertensive at home. So what the gold standard is when we look at cardiology is that you need to have an ambulatory 24-hour blood pressure measurement. That means you have an automated oscillometric system that allows to measure blood pressure like every 50 and 30 or 60 minutes, and then you do that for one day and for one night during the usual activity. So patients during the daytime do whatever they do, and at night they usually sleep, and then you can see the blood pressure profile over those 24 hours. And what people usually do is they dip at night, so blood pressure goes down at night, and this is an important and physiologically reasonable thing. So at night your blood pressure drops, and this, by the way, this if you are a non-dipper, if your blood pressure does not go down at night, this is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, even more than hypertension per se. And this is how I got interested in kind of looking at those ambulatory measurements in patients who are scheduled for major surgery. Yeah. And there are. Then we did one more study that perhaps I should talk about when we talk about this. So we did an observational pilot study in more than 350 patients, and we did those ambulatory 24-hour measurements, and this gave us the opportunity to answer a couple of interesting questions. And the first was, we looked at the pre-induction value, the value that a patient has when he just arrives at the induction area, because many anesthesiologists say, okay, I individualize blood pressure, and I ask, how do you do that? And they say, okay, I just take the pre-induction value, and this is what the patient has. And we were able to answer that question with this study, because we had mean daytime, mean nighttime values, and we had the pre-induction value. So we compared the pre-induction value to the mean daytime value, just asking the question, is the pre-induction value a good surrogate for normal daytime value? And, well, it's not.
I was just going to ask. So
the pre-induction value is a very, very poor surrogate. It has nothing to do with the normal daytime blood pressure value, so it doesn't reflect it. So this is, I wouldn't use the value that you just take just before induction as a baseline. And I wouldn't take a single value anyway. So what we then did was we looked at how do those blood pressures during nighttime relate to 65. So why did we do that? Because the nighttime blood pressure is, for me, something like an individual safe threshold. You usually don't wake up with a heart attack or myocardial injury or kidney injury or stroke in the morning. So the lowest blood pressure during night is something like the individual safe threshold, and we compared it to 65 because that is a population harm threshold. And if you do this, and this was very interesting for me, you see first there's a huge variability in nighttime pressure. This is not so surprising, but when between individuals, and it's and when you then compare it to 65, you will see that about 1/3 of the patients have lower blood pressures than 65 at night. So they have blood pressures of 50, 55, or whatever at night. And I would say that it's quite reasonable to assume that those patients may also tolerate lower pressures during surgery. But honestly, that is not the direction where my research is heading to, because I do not want to advocate for low pressures during surgery. But on the other hand, and that is more important, 2/3 of the patients during nighttime physiologic sleep never have blood pressures as low as 65. They are substantially higher. Mm-hmm. And those are the patients we want to focus on. And I would hypothesize that those patients who are never as low as 65, that those patients need higher pressures, and that you should individualize the target for them.
From a practical point of view, and I want to get further into the discussion about how we might be able to envelop and incorporate the evening circadian rhythm as a way to define that baseline. We can talk about baseline in a second. Those patients, that 2/3 of the patients who never got as low as 65, were there any characteristics of their preoperative sort of walking and talking and chewing gum daytime blood pressure? Were they prehypertensives? Were they hypertensives? Or were they normal and they just had an interesting biology?
Well, that is a very complicated question, because it's a very inhomogeneous group of patients, because you have patients in there who have high blood pressure during daytime and who have no antihypertensive treatment, and most of those do not dip at night. And this is the worst combination. So you have chronic arterial hypertension and you are a non-dipper. Then you have patients with chronic arterial hypertension who still dip at night. And this is something that we should talk to cardiologists to probably, but this may be not as bad as being hypertensive and a non-dipper.
Okay.
And then there are patients who have normal blood pressure during the daytime, but don't dip at night, or have normal and dip at night. So there is any combination that you can think of, but I still think that looking at the nighttime pressure is a good way to go when we think about intraoperative targets.
Perfect, and I love the way that we're parsing the definition of blood pressure, and it's fascinating. But point of clarification, when we say hypertension, are we talking about systolic, mean, diastolic? What is the definition of hypertension in our discussion that we're having right now?
Well, I always look at mean arterial pressure, but if you look at guidelines from cardiologist societies in Europe or in the United States, they often define it based on systolic and diastolic, of course. So in that perspective, the European guidelines for hypertension, for example, they define, and it's the same in the United States, they define an optimal blood pressure and blood pressure of 120 systolic over 80 diastolic. And if you kind of do the math here, this was would result in a mean arterial pressure of 93. So this is something that we need to keep in mind, that when we talk about intraoperative hypertension, we are still talking about very low pressures when we speak about 65. So an optimal pressure is 93 in an awake patient, of course, not having an
We fear. Spent some time years ago demonstrating in the cardiac surgical population that isolated systolic blood pressure is unto itself a predictor of risk and badness, as is isolated pulse pressure hypertension. It's a fascinating conversation. It's complex. And I just want to lay foundation that we're talking about mean arterial pressure.
Yeah, well, that is, we are used to talk about mean in the OR. There are data that the associations between hypotension, whether you define it on systolic or mean, are equally strong. The association with outcomes are equally strong, whether you look at systolic or mean. It's just... Well, in critical care and anesthesiology, we are just used to look at mean. But I agree that we should look at all three blood pressure components. All three blood pressure components have an important physiologic meaning.
So, Ben, before we move on to the second part of our conversation, which is are we looking in the wrong place, I believe you've recently received a substantial grant to address the issue from this perspective, which sounded to many people implausible, i.e. getting ambulatory blood pressures measured preoperatively, but you've demonstrated it's achievable, it is feasible, it's plausible. Can you tell us about that grant and what the study design looks like?
Oh, absolutely, I would love to do that. This will be the IMPROVE study. So this is something that we worked on during the last couple of years. We did a couple of pilot studies and trials, and well, we were even able to show that chronic arterial hypertension and non-dipping on ambulatory monitoring is an independent risk factor of intraoperative hypertension. So we really established a physiological basis for all of that. And we are now happy that the German Research Foundation funded that trial with more than 2.5 million euros. And we hope that we will have the first patient in within this year. And the basic concept of the trial is to test the hypothesis that individualized blood pressure management based on the ambulatory nighttime mean arterial pressure improves the composite of postoperative perfusion-related complications compared to routine care that will be maintaining blood pressure above 65.
And in your treatment algorithm or approach, how will you mitigate the risk of people running vasopressors without addressing volume and flow?
Well, first of all, we have an upper intervention threshold that we defined as a mean arterial pressure of 110, because you will be surprised how high nighttime blood pressures are in some patients. Okay. And this is what we saw in the pilot trials. And we don't have a specific treatment protocol, because we assume that that it's a multi-center trial in 16 center university centers in Germany, but we trust physicians that they are able to combine fluids, vasopressors, and inotropes to avoid hypertension. But at that point, we want to be somehow pragmatic. We know that the preoperative assessment of the baseline ambulatory value is considered quite complex, but I think physiology is complex too, and we need to make an effort to get that baseline value right. On the other hand, the intraoperative period is quite pragmatic, so we will have the individualized target or the 65, and there's no specific treatment protocol.
In that study, though, you don't have a specific protocol for managing blood pressure vis-a-vis vasoactive medicines or volume or whatever. Are you asking your sites to measure it so that you may want to do a post hoc analysis in that sense?
Of course, we will record and measure all of the therapeutic interventions. Mm-hmm. And what you mentioned is an important point. You know, we kind of need to balance a couple of dangerous things here. One dangerous thing may be hypotension. The other dangerous thing may be excessive fluid therapy. And the next dangerous thing may be very, very high doses of vasopressors. Nevertheless, I think that it's a good approach to not use a specific protocol that... would trigger therapy that would rarely be used in clinical practice. You know, we know from our goal-directed therapy studies, for example, of course we give a lot of inotropes in those patients, but we hardly see any inotropes in patients who are not in a randomized trial. So we try to keep it pragmatic with respect to the treatment algorithm.
Yeah, lots of variability.
So congratulations on getting the grant. Thank you for all your great work
that
in that space.
Wonderful.
And now we're going to shift gear to postoperative.
We are. I mean, during the conversations that we've had over the course, well, forever, actually, in Top Med Talk, but a lot this week and weekend, is talking about, you know, we know what happens intraoperatively and as anesthesia, we're so focused on that. But what happens whenever we drop our patients off and everyone is tucked in nicely and looks perfect, that, you know, everything happens after that time. So wanted to talk to you a little bit about, you know, that transition of care and where we are in the space. We know we're lacking in monitoring capabilities and the consistency of monitoring, frequency of monitoring. Where do you stand on a lot of that that topic?
Well, I think this will be one of the game changers of the next decade, probably, in perioperative medicine. So if you think about it in a way like, well, if you are having surgery, at no time in life you will be as closely monitored as during those 2 to 6 or whatever hours. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of monitoring in place. You have an anesthesiologist at the bedside. You have an anesthetic nurse with you all the time. And then you may have close monitoring in the post anesthesia care unit, and then you are kind of pushed into a black hole.
Yeah, yeah.
You go to the normal ward.
Yeah.
And we always say that we're there to spot monitoring like every 4 to 8 hours,
yeah.
But not even that is true in many institutions, and sometimes our nurses are even shy to disturb the patient or things like that. And we simply... In clinical routine practice, we simply do not know how much hypertension there is, and there are a few observational studies now using monitoring methods that more or less accurately and precisely measure blood pressure that that looked at the incidence of postoperative hypertension, and postoperative hypertension is absolutely common. And we know from at least one secondary analysis of a big study that the association or the odds ratio for postoperative major complications is a lot higher when you have hypotension on postoperative days 1 to 4. So postoperative hypotension surely is an issue. Yeah. And at the moment we are simply ignoring it because we are just not measuring it.
Yeah.
One of the things that just struck me from that topic is, first of all, congratulations on your proactive approach to define baseline, which has haunted us for decades, and I think it's elegant and frankly just cool. Postoperative hypertension, same baseline?
Good question.
That is a difficult one. I think that we know very, very little about postoperative harm thresholds and postoperative lower interventional thresholds. I would say that they are presumably a little bit higher than during surgery, but this is more or less speculation and not based on data. The main problem at the moment still is that we simply miss it. The problem is, well, blood pressure is a complex biosignal. It's very hard to measure, and it's even hard to measure when you have an arterial catheter. And now imagine how you need to measure it in a patient who is treated on a normal ward after surgery. Because, well, we want those patients moving around.
Yeah.
So you need monitoring that is attached to the patient but without any cables. So he needs to be able to do physical therapy, walk around, stuff like this. But at the same time, we should have continuous monitoring of various vital signs, of course. But I'm very much interested in blood pressure, of course. But it's blood pressure is perhaps the most the biosignal that is it's very hard to measure. You know, we have good sensors for saturation, heart rate, respiratory rate, even position or movement. You know, our cell phones in the pockets they monitor movement all the time.
Yeah.
But the problem with blood pressure is it's a complicated biosignal, and I'm not aware of a system that reliably measures blood pressure on the ward without any cables attached to the patient at the moment.
And to be practical at the moment, do we need that? I know we'd love to have it, but to make progress, could we work with heart rate and respiratory rate because there's a prodromal period where there's usually variations in respiratory rate and pulse rate prior to a sag in blood pressure because of sympathetic compensation. And we then need to be, at least be able to react with continuous non-invasive blood pressure, etc., which is, that's feasible at the moment.
Yeah,
absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think we especially need to look at the combination of different vital signs. You know, it's we know that respiratory, for example, is the most sensitive variable when it comes to predicting complications. It's but we need to integrate the different signals. You know, it's, and we need to have smart alarms because it makes a difference whether a patient is lying in bed or whether he's exercising. So a heart rate of 120 may be normal when he's exercising in a physical therapy, but it's not normal when he's in bed and things like that. So it's a combining different biosignals, vital signs, having smart alarms, integrating taking into account the what the patient is doing at the moment. So it's contextualized monitoring.
And that's what we're doing with our early warning scores everywhere at the moment. But it's a nurse-led, chart-based,
absolutely
very slow cadence of measurement. We're just trying to make that continuous.
That exactly
it's
the
all
point.
We're trying to do.
And this is the point when we discussed this with our hospital management. So rapid response teams and stuff like this, those can only be as good as the information they have. So, and, well, monitoring all of the patients continuously, that will create dense data streams. You know, there will be a lot of data, and we need to we need to develop concepts that require a cultural change. You know, there may be a new specialty, like somebody is analyzing all those incoming data, and perhaps we need some support there, like machine learning, decision support systems, whatever.
Clinicians to be able to look at that.
And then at some point a clinician needs to kind of get those informations and simply call his colleague on the floor and tell him, you need to go to room 3 now because we have a combination of a low saturation and a high heart rate, and this is new and the patient is lying in bed.
Yeah.
And this would be the dream for the future, that we really start monitoring our patients in the hospital, because it's kind of strange that we know that those patients develop those complications are under direct supervision and we simply do not recognize it.
We were talking to Dan Sessler and Frederick Michaud yesterday, and one of the things that Frederick pointed out is for many, many patients who come in, we ask them to take off their smartwatch.
True, that is a good point, yeah.
And put them into a void of information. Whereas if we let them keep it on,
absolutely,
we'd already be in a better place.
Well, what about the ambulatory blood pressures that you're doing preoperatively? I mean, bringing that in, I mean, that people make things like that work. So surely we could figure out how to do it in the hospital.
I think that would be better than checking blood pressure only every 4 to 8 hours.
Yes.
But again, this would be only every 15 or 30 minutes. So it's more high frequency, but far away from continuous monitoring. Yeah. I think we are kidding about it now, but it would, it would increase patient safety compared to checking blood pressure like every 4 to 8 hours,
Just from a practical standpoint, walk us through how you are measuring preoperative blood pressures to establish what that personalized blood pressure, albeit systolic, diastolic, or mean, would be that would help guide, if you will, your baseline. Is it prime time? Are we doing that? And should we be doing that? And how can we be doing that routinely?
Well, first of all, it's a routine procedure. It's something that that cardiologists do all the time because it's in the guidelines as the gold standard method to diagnose hypertension. So you only can diagnose hypertension when you have an ambulatory 24-hour measurement. So this is something that we didn't invent. It's not new. It's simply we kind of transferred it to perioperative medicine. Maybe because I'm an internist too, so I'm not only an anesthesiologist and intensivist, but I worked in internal medicine for many years, so this is something that was not new for me, and this is also why I was so surprised that everybody thinks it's something that is new or fancy or whatever. It's absolutely standard.
I'm looking around this wonderful, exhibit hall, and I do not see anyone introducing that concept. So I say that in a tongue-in-cheek way.
Absolutely.
It's novel to this audience.
Yeah, the feasibility, people, anesthesia providers thinking in their mind, the feasibility of this. They're like, there's no way we could do that. But cardiologists,
and I tell you something, patients are absolutely thrilled about it. So again, everybody thought we were crazy, and that you will never find a patient who is accepting this.
Yeah.
And I told them, well, I had it myself for a couple of times, so I slept well. It's something that cardiologists do, and we did that in more than 1,000 more than 1,000 patients in the meantime, and we hardly had any patient who complained, and just the opposite. They are asking for their values, of course, and we provide them their measurements, and they take them to their cardiologists, and it helps the specialty too, because it's really a concept of perioperative medicine. So we do a baseline diagnosis of their blood pressure profile. We take care of blood pressure during surgery, and we can even give the results of the measurement to the patient, and he can use it for postoperative blood pressure control with his cardiologist.
Do you think that there's a way that we can work with our cardiology colleagues here, you know, like in the U.S., for example, to do that?
We can have a whole nother session on this.
I know. I'm just thinking about it.
I was actually asking in a practical way how we in this space can envelop that as part of our routine.
For sure.
I love the fact that you're doing it. I get it. I respect it. I wish we were doing that more routinely. Rather than being dependent on others to do it for us, how can we just routinely envelop that into our routine?
Well, we simply bought the devices, and they are not too expensive.
Okay.
We have 40 of them, and we give it to the patient before surgery. Patients are happy to take it. We tell them how to use it. They can even start it whenever they want. So they just need to wrap around the cuff, and they start the measurement.
Right.
And then they bring it back when they are admitted to hospital for surgery, or they send it in just using mail, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we should wrap in a second. We're nearly out of time. But anything, any other little gems you picked up at the meeting?
Well, it's, of course, the major news, also it wasn't so new for me, of course, was a discussion about around POISE 3, the blood pressure results.
Yeah.
It's something that, of course, is one of the major news. I still think that there are a lot of unanswered questions.
Oh, for sure.
We need more data on intraoperative blood pressure in those patients. There are large ongoing randomized trials on that topic who will focus on higher risk patients. There's an interesting trial in Amsterdam that's going on, focusing a little bit more on individualized targets, but not on a patient level like we will do. So I think it's what I take away from that Congress is mainly not the results, because I already knew them, but the discussions around the POISE 3 results with all the colleagues.
So I'll finish and I'll let you go after that. So what's your takeaway that you would go back, if you went back to residents and they wanted to know quickly, what did you make of POISE 3?
Well, first of all, it was a comparison between 65 and 85, it's maintaining blood pressure above 65 or 85 doesn't make a difference, but we didn't look at what we usually find as hypotension, and that is below 65, so it's the message by no means can be that hypotension is not important, because this is not a study comparing hypotension versus no hypotension. It is inpatient surgery, but I think we need the association between hypotension and outcomes is especially important in high-risk patients, so we need to focus on high-risk patients. Mm. And I think the jury is still out what the optimal target value is. By no means it ends the story of hypotension. But it's an important signal. It is what it is. It's no different. At the moment, you cannot recommend to increase blood pressure above 65 to 85 in every patient. But I still think we should do it in the individual patients, and that is what we try to prove.
I was just going to add to that, and I love that interpretation. It's a very narrow snapshot of a very large and complex topic. What is blood pressure? Is it hypertension defined by systolic, mean, or diastolic? Is it blood pressure defined by preoperative, intraoperative, or postoperative? And now you introduced another, if you will, dimension, which is hypertension dippers or non-hypertensive dippers or hypertensive non-dippers. And it's a whole nother, if you will, slice of that very complex pie. So I think we are only now beginning to appreciate how much we don't know. Thank you for widening that playing field for us, and we shouldn't overinterpret and underestimate how little we know in this space. So it's a long journey that we're looking forward to hearing more about.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Bernd, thank you so much for joining us on Top Med Talk. Excited to hear more from you in the coming time and about the projects that you're working on. So good luck with everything and good luck with the new grant.
Thank you very much.
And especially, I can't wait to hear what happens at Prato. You guys are all headed there tomorrow, yeah. Mm. So all good news from there, I'm sure. Well, thanks for listening to Top Med Talk. You know, you can always find us on your favorite social media platform, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook. We are there. And at topmedtalk.com, everything from your anesthesia will be there, all the wonderful conversations that we had. And as Monty said before, if there's a topic in perioperative medicine that you're interested in, go to our search engine on topmedtalk.com and you can find conversations about it over the years.
And if you can't, let us know.
That's right. Please do reach out to us. I know we've had some people reaching out in the recent months about wanting to have conversations about things they're interested in, so we're going to try and do that. And be sure to check us out. The next meeting we're going to be at, Monty?
Great question. It's Prato.
No. EBPOM London, the World Congress.
The World Congress. that we're going to be at. The other people at the table are going to be at.
No.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, our upcoming summer meeting.
The EBPOM. World Congress.
Yep.
World 25th Congress. Anniversary.
It is the 25th anniversary. So do check us out. We're going to be selling virtual tickets or in-person tickets, I mean.
I believe it's the Silver Jubilee.
It is
somebody's Jubilee. All right. Everyone have a great day. Thanks so much for listening to Top Med Talk. Cheers. Bye.
Ciao, ciao.
Top Med Talk.
Desiree Chappell with Top Med Talk. It has been an exciting year, and there is so much more to come. Now, I'm joined here with Monty Mithen. Monty, what is coming up?
Well, next, Top Med Talk are going to be coming to you live from the European Society of Anesthesiology from Milan in Italy. You'll find us on the GE booth in the trade exhibition. We'll be there intermittently, and we'll probably pop up in a few other places. So I'm there with Desiree, and Sol Aronson's coming in, and Henry Howe. And after that, Desiree, where do we go?
It is time for the 25th anniversary World Congress of Perioperative Medicine in London, right? Live.
From the UCL campus to celebrate our 25th anniversary. So that's really exciting. And then I think we've got the next one in August with your organization in America.
It is. It's in Chicago. It's the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists. Monty and I are going to pop up there, have some great conversations, and then it's on to
Dingle. So that takes us into the autumn and winter season. More about that to follow.
And then, of course, we're going to be rounding out the year with the American Society of Anesthesiologists in New Orleans for their annual Congress. So super excited about all the events for the year. Don't miss us. Be sure to check us out on topmedtalk.com and on your favorite podcatcher. We are there with late-breaking anesthesia and perioperative news. Right, Monty?
Absolutely. See you soon.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to Clinical View Podcasts, brought to you by GE Healthcare. Expand your view at clinicalview.gehealthcare.com.